Felicia Maselli lost her son to heroin. 2 years ago, she created a fake cemetery in the front lawn of her suburban Chicago home. She told NPR she did it to draw attention to what she called an epidemic of heroin.
It just angers me and it makes me want to cry because maybe my son would still be here if people were talking about it and doing something about it.
Today, we're focusing on how heroin is especially affecting central Illinois. We'll talk to a former addict, speak with two journalists who've been chronicling this problem, and a provider of treatment services. We also find out, how is the Illinois budget impasse affecting this issue? Later, how much sleep should babies and children be getting a night? Probably much more than you think. We'll find out about a new study by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Good morning, I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is the 21st. Today we're talking about the heroin problem in Illinois. It's not just bad, it's getting worse. More of the drug and higher purity heroin is pouring into the United States and into Illinois. In terms of numbers, federal data shows that the number of people who reported using heroin in a 12-month period nationwide more than doubled between 2007 and 2014. There's more than 10,000 people who overdosed on heroin in any given year. But it's not the numbers that tell the full story. It's the lives lost or ruined, and in sometimes the lives that have been rebuilt. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by two reporters from the Bloomington Pantograph who were behind a recent series that looked into what's driving the heroin epidemic in Illinois, who it's affecting, and some of the creative solutions to help people who are addicted to the drug. We'll also be speaking with an addiction treatment provider in Clinton. If you experience with experiences with this or if you have questions, as always, you're welcome to join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well to 21STShow. That's 21st Show. Is our handle. But first, one of the stories that stood out in the reporting was the profile of Becca Hinshaw. She lives in the Pontiac area, and she joins us now by phone. Becca, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for talking with us.
Hi there.
Becca, you've been sober for 6 years now. So congratulations for that. That's hard work, and I want to just acknowledge that. But you described the time you were using heroin as a roller coaster. When you think back about that time, about your experience and your family and the people around you, how much damage did heroin do to your life?
I wasn't even a person anymore, really. Like, it just damaged everything. Relationships, didn't work. Just damaged, like, my whole life.
And when you talk about that damage, I understand that you lost your former husband and your boyfriend to heroin, and I can't even begin to understand how awful that must have been. Were those moments when you stepped back and thought, I need to change this?
I wasn't with my ex-husband at the time, but it didn't even make me think. Like, I was just still using, and, you know, like, I just kept wanting more. It was so hard to get off of.
Why heroin?
And I was clean for 9 months when my boyfriend passed away.
You made it for 9 months, and then what happened?
And he used and passed away, and that just made me so angry, and just, I hated it. Like, I hated the heroin, and I never wanted to go back.
And was that the turning point for you?
Well, the turning point was getting in trouble, and I lost a relationship with my oldest son, and my youngest son was with me and stuff, and I thought I was going to lose him, too. Just that feeling away, you know, like being away from your child, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't, like, lose another relationship.
Becca, when did you first start using heroin?
It was around 18.
And were you able to, and how long did you use heroin before you were able to finally become sober?
Oh, a good over 10 years.
And how many times did you try to quit during that time?
Oh, I tried quite a few times. I just always wanted it. I would drink instead for a while, and then I would just go back.
And you said that it damaged your relationships with your, how many children do you have?
I have two.
You have two. Okay. We're speaking to Becca Henshaw. She was profiled as part of a series called Dope Sick, The Heroin Epidemic, and it ran earlier this month in the Bloomington Pantograph, as well as several other papers in downstate Illinois. And I wanted to bring two other people into this conversation. The people who first introduced us to Becca, Kevin Barlow and Edith Brady Lunny, they're two of the reporters in the series, and they're both joining us from the studios of our partner station, WGLT in Bloomington Normal. Kevin and Edith, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin, I wondered if you can start by telling us a little bit about, as we're hearing Becca's story, you've been reporting on this for some time. What was sort of the idea, or what kind of prompted this, you all going back and doing this whole series that you all did about heroin?
Well, it's just the fact that we're hearing more and more about it. We hear more and more from the coroners, from police and law enforcement, and Edith and I both live in Clinton, and DeWitt County's had several deaths over the past couple of years, and you know, just around the newsroom we're talking, it's like, you know, something has to happen to get this to stop. And obviously there's people in DeWitt County who felt the same way, and there's a death, social media just kind of explodes over there, I see just a lot of people talking about it and how people come clean during those times, and they say, you know, hey, I've got this problem too, or I've dealt with this problem in the past, I've got family members or friends, you know, and we need to band together to kind of get this under control. And it's such a huge problem, it's not an easy fix.
Edith, I wonder if you can share with us if you can give us a sense of how big you think the heroin problem is throughout the state of Illinois.
Well, what we know in Illinois kind of mirrors what we know across the country. It's been termed an epidemic in our state and in our local communities. And we're seeing more and more of this intersection of the criminal justice system with people who are truly more addicts than criminals. And so that's kind of the track that we cover on our beats is, where does addiction play its role in the criminal justice system, and what are the changes that we're seeing in the approach that's being taken to handle people who are lucky enough to survive in opiate addiction?
And Becca, that happened to you. I know a judge 6 years ago decided on treatment and probation rather than prison. And I wonder if you can share a little bit when you were in front of that judge and he said that you should go, I assume it was a he, maybe it was a she, decided on treatment.
It was a he.
Okay. When the judge decided, she decided on treatment and probation rather than prison, did you have a sense of relief at that point when she said you're not going to prison, but you need to figure out how to get help?
Yes, it was a huge relief because I never really gotten like a chance with being in trouble. And I just knew like I had to take that chance.
And I want to ask you, how important do you think it is when you think about chances, not just a first chance, but a second, a third, or a fourth chance when we're talking about heroin? How important is that?
It's really important because a lot of times, like the first few times, you just, like, it's so hard to get off of. And you just need to, like, keep pushing it and keep pushing people back, and I think they will eventually get it.
And Kevin, I wanted to ask you about that because what Becca is saying, there's actually a lot of scientific basis for this about heroin and how difficult it is in terms of people being able to finally combat this addiction. How important do you think there's more of a recognition among the law enforcement community about how to treat addiction? Do you think that there's better conversations that are happening now around that?
There are, and people are learning all the time and doing more studies. But you know, like Becca will be the first to tell you, usually treatment, your first rehab assignment is probably not going to work. It usually takes people 7 or 8 times before it really starts to sink in. And you know, some people may be able to go get help and be fine the first time, but it's a powerful drug that people who have never used it don't understand. I've never used it, but I've talked to people who have, or family members who have, and it's just, it takes such control. Once you get hooked, it's impossible to get off of, it seems. I have a lot of respect for Becca for getting off of it finally and turning her life around.
And as we're talking about that, Kevin, as we're talking about, I think people tend to have stereotypes about who they think is addicted to heroin, and they think it's people on the streets or shooting up in alleys. What has your reporting showed about this?
It's not the homeless guy down the street in the alley. A lot of people get addicted to heroin after surgeries, for instance. The doctor will prescribe pills for a couple of months, and then the pills run out and people are still in pain and they're looking for something. And heroin is cheap. It's, people can find it fairly easily. And people turn to heroin basically for pain medication, and then they're hooked.
Edith, as we're thinking about that, and as Kevin's saying, this opiate addiction, or as people are addicted to painkillers, I know that people who have followed this issue may know there's been an effort in recent years to crack down on painkiller abuse. The FDA has put out some pretty strict guidelines in the past few years about Oxy and a couple other painkiller medication that have been shown to be sort of a gateway or a path that people start on these painkillers, as Kevin's saying, and then they end up getting heroin because it's cheaper. Has that effort in recent years, has it helped reduce the problem of opioid and heroin addiction?
I believe it has. There really is a very serious and growing awareness with physicians about this issue. The problem is that we have a generation or two, at least, of people who have become addicted to these drugs. And we know that it takes a very long time for people to have a successful outcome, oftentimes from multiple treatments. So the awareness has come, and I think that has helped shorten the list of people who are getting them through doctors. That being said, that's also part of the reason that we're seeing the big uptick in the heroin use, is that heroin is available on the street and it's cheaper.
It's cheaper. How much cheaper is it?
It's much, much cheaper. I mean, you can buy heroin for just a few bucks when you're on the street. You know, it's not at all expensive, but people will, beg, borrow, and steal to get the money that they need to do it with.
So are you saying that ironically, in a way, because of the crackdown on prescription painkillers, that maybe have more people even turning to heroin because it's easier and it's cheaper and it's more available?
Absolutely. We know that that's part of the reason that people are turning to heroin. And it's also becoming cheaper on the street because dealers have found cheaper ways to cut it and to mix it. And to put it out on the street. So it's a combination of things there that's created sort of, this perfect storm, if you will, and created the epidemic.
Kevin, you wrote about how in central Illinois, in this part of the state where we are right now, it's between Chicago, which deals with one type of heroin, and St. Louis, which has another heroin market. Can you describe that a little bit more and explain that to us?
Well, yeah, part of the heroin is coming from Mexico. And part of the heroin is coming from South America. And, we're right in the center of the country and right in the center of the state. And so we're basically getting it from two different sides, and it's different types of heroin. And, that creates a problem for people who are buying it on the streets because there are different forms and some may be more potent than others. And you don't always know what you're buying. So if you know that you can use a certain amount of heroin this time, well, next time you might use that same amount, but it might be mixed differently and you might get a whole different result.
Becca, what do you want people to know or to understand about heroin?
That you can get clean. I know it's hard, and it's a lot of work, but you can, if you work for your recovery, like you work to get that drug, you can get clean. It's not nothing to mess with. It like takes everything from you. If you haven't used, don't use.
And why is it so important for you to speak out publicly about your experience now with heroin?
There's just so many deaths. Like, I'm from Pontiac, and there's been so many deaths close to me, friends, and, of course, my loved ones. And I just want to help somebody, like, people to know that there is help and you can get clean.
Becca, thank you so much for sharing your story. That's Becca Henshaw. When we come back, we are going to be talking to, we're going to continue our conversation with Kevin Barlow and with Edith Brady Lunny. Kevin covers public safety. Edith is a legal reporter. Both of them are at the Bloomington Pantograph. They did a series. It's called Dope Sick, the Heroin Epidemic. And we're tweeting out all of those links to all of the stories that they've done. It ran earlier this month in the Pantograph and a couple other papers. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation with them. And we're going to pick up what Becca was saying about treatment. We're going to be speaking with some programs that work in Clinton to work with substance abuse. We're going to talk about the current budget impasse, how that's affecting things, and continue this conversation about how law enforcement and other communities are grappling with this issue of heroin. As always, you can join our conversation by calling 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Liz Larson says this is a very important issue to our community and countless others across the nation. Keep the comments coming. Stay tuned. We'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Over the years, drug traffickers in Mexico and South America have made Chicago a hub for heroin. There's even a section of 290 in Chicago area known as the Heroin Highway. But the problem is statewide. It's not just in Chicago. Last year, lawmakers in Springfield passed the Heroin Crisis Act to give communities more tools against heroin and opioid addiction. But that's just a start. And now, with the state budget standoff, it could cut off some of the services that people need most. We've been hearing stories from people who've been affected by this, and now we wanted to talk about how others are trying to deal with this issue, whether that's law enforcement or substance abuse counselors and other treatment centers. And we've been talking about all of this with two of the reporters who worked on the series Dope Sick, the Heroin Epidemic. It ran earlier this month in the Bloomington Pantograph and several other papers downstate. Kevin Barlow and Edith Bradith Lunny are with us from the studios of our partner station, WGLT in Bloomington Normal. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. That's 21st Show. We just got a question from Joel on Twitter. Edith, I'm wondering if you can answer. Joel wants to know, I would like to know the rate of heroin users who are incarcerated in Illinois. Do we have a sense of that problem?
I can't tell you precisely what the percentage is dealing just with heroin, but I can tell you that the largest percentage of people who are in prison, particularly on Class 3 and Class 4 offenses, are related to drug crimes. So it's the bulk of the population in Illinois prisons. And when you're talking about heroin, sometimes those charges are, you know, enhanced penalties. So not only are people in prison, but they can be in prison longer.
What do you mean by enhanced penalties, Edith?
If you are convicted of selling a certain drug and or a certain amount of a drug in Illinois within 1,000 feet of a, what's called a drug-free zone.
Like a school.
School, public park, several other places, you are going to face stiffer penalties than if you were selling those same drugs in areas outside a protected zone. So a lot of times people are caught in that net as well, and they get, you know, some of them 6 to 30 years without the possibility of probation. So you can face some very, very stiff penalties in Illinois if you are caught selling drugs like heroin and cocaine in certain zones.
And Kevin, one law enforcement official quoted in the series emphasized, and I think this is a really important point for people, you can't arrest your way out of this problem. What did he mean by that?
Oh, and we hear that all the time. It's basically what they're saying is you can throw people in jail, but that doesn't necessarily fix the problem, because once they get out of jail or prison, they're likely to just go right back to their bad habits. And what they're trying to say is people need help. They need, they need some kind of assistance in getting over the problem so that they don't go back to using once they get out.
And you all have written about how several communities, including Dixon, Illinois, have implemented what they call a Safe Passage Initiative. Can either of you explain what that is?
Yes, that was actually started out in a community in Massachusetts. And the Dixon police chief picked up on that and started his own version of it in Dixon. And he has a core of volunteers who are available 24 hours a day. So if someone makes the decision that they want to start working on recovery, they can come to the police station. And instead of being arrested or sent away, they will be matched up with a volunteer who transports them to a detox center. And in Dixon, they are working through a partnership with Chestnut Health Systems here in Bloomington at the Crisis Stabilization Center that opened about a year ago. And about 70 people have come in the past year from Dixon to the Crisis Stabe Center here in McLean County for their first step in working on a recovery path.
That's Edith Brady Lenny. She's a reporter with the Bloomington Pantograph. She's here with her colleague. They're at our partner station WGLT in Bloomington Normal with Kevin Barlow as her colleague, and they're talking about the series they did, Dope Sick. I wanted to bring someone else into the conversation. It's actually from both of your hometowns in Clinton, Illinois, and it's the DeWitt County Human Resource Center based in Clinton. Last year, they helped around 200 people with substance abuse. The organization is the only licensed provider of substance abuse counseling for the county, and it's part of a task force for DeWitt County set up to deal with heroin. And the nonprofit is also in danger of closing because of the state budget impasse, so much so that the group set up a GoFundMe campaign recently. They're asking for $125,000. Their executive director joins us now from Clinton, Lynn Scoville. Lynn, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about this on the 21st.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Lynn, can you explain how much the need, especially for heroin treatment, has been an issue within your county over the past few years?
It has become an increasing problem within DeWitt County, particularly within the past year. We've especially seen an uptick in really the past 6 months. I was just checking in with our substance abuse providers that are here at the agency and to kind of get some idea of what they're currently seeing. And they estimated that there have been at least four either accidental or intentional overdoses with heroin just since January of this year. And with a small county like we have, that's a huge number. So it is a growing problem. And one of the reasons that we see it's a growing problem is it's inexpensive. You can get it without a prescription. You can buy it on the street. And it is often a gateway drug with things like OxyContin or other things in the opiate family. So if someone is not able to obtain those opiates through the pharmacy, through their doctors, they turn to heroin.
Lynn, when you say that you're the only licensed provider of substance abuse treatment counseling for the county, what do you all provide for people?
Well, we provide numerous sources. Sometimes the first access are treatment through a crisis call. They call into our crisis hotline, and our trained staff is available 24/7 to, you know, determine whether it is a mental health issue, whether it is a substance abuse issue, and then make the appropriate referrals there. If it's something that the counselor, if it is substance abuse, and the counselor feels that it can be handled through outpatient therapy, then we go ahead and initiate the treatment with them. And there are a variety of different techniques that our counselors use to assist people with their recovery and to support them during their recovery. It really depends upon the individual and what their particular circumstances are.
Lynn, you mentioned the 24-hour crisis intervention. That's also, you guys are the only ones at the Human Resource Center that do that in the county. And when you say you provide 24-hour crisis intervention, what else do you all do when people are calling you for help?
So normally a crisis call is initiated by the individual, and if someone who is experiencing an acute psychiatric crisis or a severe substance abuse issue, they feel hopeless, they feel they need to speak to someone immediately, they may present as a danger to themselves or others, and our counselors work first over the phone to stabilize them, to find out, you know, what their risk factors are, and will then, if necessary, meet one-on-one with that individual on an emergency basis. And, you know, we do that 24/7. So we see a variety of calls that come into our crisis line. Our goal is for the, if it's a mental health issue, to stabilize them, to develop a safety plan with them so that they don't require immediate hospitalization. If we can't do that, then we will facilitate a hospitalization. If it is somebody who's experiencing a substance abuse issue, then we would determine, again, what their risk factors are, if outpatient or inpatient would be a more appropriate treatment plan for them, and then the counselor would then work to either facilitate the hospitalization or make follow-up arrangements to receive the treatment through us on an outpatient basis.
That's Lynn Scoville. She's the executive director of the DeWitt County Human Resource Center. And Lynn, you all are part of a task force for the county to deal with heroin. What's that task force, and how is the county trying to work on this issue?
Well, we're coming at it from just a community-wide basis, because we feel that everyone really is a stakeholder in this in our community. And so it was actually proposed by the DeWitt County Sheriff, Jared Schaffner, and it involves various sectors of our community. So we have law enforcement, we have probation, we have treatment for providers, we have faith-based community, just all aspects. We have people who have survived and are in recovery as part of the task force, and we also have individual family members who may have lost a family member or whose family member is struggling with addiction. And we're trying to really kind of strategize, figure out why it is an issue in our county, and then attack it from a strategic basis.
Kevin and Edith, we heard about the Safe Passage Program in Dixon. We're hearing now about the task force in DeWitt County. Do you all find our communities, particularly in Central Illinois, are they trying to work on this problem together in these, bringing in all of these different stakeholders and different organizations, nonprofits and law enforcement? Do you think that they're trying to do that by are you seeing this as a trend per county?
Yeah, we are. Particularly, each county seems to be doing something kind of on their own. Livingston County is doing something on their own. Logan County has had issues, and they're trying to do something on their own. A lot of these counties have had presentations and gone around and trying to educate the public. And I think what we hear is education is a huge part of this, that people need to know that, you know, we talked about it earlier, it's not just a homeless guy in an alley, it's our citizens, and every county is kind of trying to do something on their own. At some point, you know, I think there's going to be a little bit more cooperation between the counties when they see what programs work.
Yeah, it sounds like everyone's kind of going it alone, where it might help resources if everyone kind of pooled.
And there are some regional things going on. There was a task force organized by Ray LaHood in Peoria a couple of months ago, and so a lot of legislators and law enforcement officials got together there and discussed the problem. So there is kind of a regional feel to it as well, but a lot of the counties are just trying to come up with a plan on their own for their individual county.
And you mentioned prevention. Lynn, I wanted to ask you, because I know that you all at DeWitt County Human Resource Center, you do prevention, particularly with young people. We know scientifically how even more damaging to young people's, to teenagers' brains it is when they start using heroin at a younger age, how much harder it is for them to get off of heroin, almost twice as hard, I believe, if I'm correct in the statistics, in terms of how many different attempts they have to make at recovery in order to overcome this addiction. Is that part of what you all are trying to educate young people around, that issue, Lynn?
Yes, exactly. And we do all grade levels. So we have a grant from the state that is a substance abuse prevention program for youth. And we have a prevention specialist that goes into our various schools in the county and does a graduated curriculum. So, you know, a curriculum that you're going to work on with fourth graders is going to be very different than the curriculum you work on with high schoolers. So, you know, it is designed to, you know, flow kind of seamlessly where they're at developmentally and as to what they can, you know, what they can learn and retain. So it's our goal with the program and our programs that we use are evidence-based, that if they receive the message over and over and over again, that's much better than a one-shot deal where they would just hear it and, you know, it not be reinforced time after time after time. So we really work to make sure that we are hitting all of those different age groups with this graduated curriculum that that they can handle as they develop.
And Lynn, you all don't just do addiction treatment and prevention. You also work with a few other programs. I know that there are people with developmental disabilities who work at your thrift store. What else does the Human Resource Center do for DeWitt County?
Well, we provide the only psychiatrist in DeWitt County. There is not a practicing psychiatrist in our county, and so we contract with a psychiatrist out of Decatur. He comes to our site 2 days a month, and he sees our clients that are in need of psychotropic medications. So these would be those with, you know, a diagnosis maybe such as bipolar, schizophrenia, psychosis, something of that nature, where in addition to therapy, they really need medication to help control and you know, help them with their recovery so that they
Lynn,
can lead.
Yeah. Can I ask you, we mentioned the GoFundMe campaign at the top of this.
Yeah.
How much have you all raised?
Our GoFundMe campaign has raised a little over $1,000 at this point, but we have received additional funds through donations through our thrift store. You know, we have a jar in there. People have been donating to that. We've received over $2,000 there. We're getting checks in sporadically from people saying, we just want to help, but they may not be really familiar with GoFundMe. We've also been fortunate to receive offerings from several of our churches in the area.
Is that going to be enough to keep you guys open?
Unfortunately, no. We are owed in quite a bit by the state of Illinois with the lack of a budget this year, and we just cannot overcome the gap at this point. So as of right now, we are just completely tapped out of cash. I know the General Assembly is going into session today. We've been working with our local legislators and the governor's office to see if there was anything they could do to help us in this short term, you know, to where we're in kind of this summer drought where we don't have access to some of our contract money because the contract year is over. So as of right now, unfortunately, we are slated to close our doors to clients in all of our programs on June 30. So at the end of the fiscal year, DeWitt County Human Resource Center will close for client services.
Lynn, if you can stick around for a minute, I just want to just touch base. We got to take a break, but if you can stick around for a minute or two and just talk about the closing and what that means for the community, we would appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay. Stay tuned to the 21st. We'll pick up this conversation in just a minute.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this hour, we've been talking about the heroin epidemic in Illinois. We've been talking to two reporters from the Bloomington Pantograph about their series Dope Sick that ran earlier this month, chronicling this problem throughout central Illinois. Kevin Barlow and Edith Brady Lenny are with me from our partner station, WGLT. Also on the line from central Illinois, we've been speaking with Lynn Scoville. She's the executive director of the DeWitt County Human Resource Center. As you just heard her say, they're the only licensed provider of substance abuse treatment. They're the only provider of 24-hour crisis intervention in that county. And now, because of the state budget impasse, they'll be shutting their doors. Kevin and Edith, I mean, as we're hearing this news about this one center in DeWitt County because of the budget impasse not being able to function, I wanted to just ask you, as we're in this really unprecedented period of social service providers not getting funding, how that's trickling over and affecting counties as well. What are you all seeing, especially as we're hearing Lynn say this is heroin is an even bigger problem this year than it was last year. What other effects are you seeing of the state budget impasse on different providers?
I think the main thing about this is it's a substance abuse problem, and it can turn into a mental health issue and then back into a law enforcement issue. And so what you're going to find if you have centers like this closing or more crime, more things that police really don't know how to handle or can't handle, don't have the resources to handle, and that's what is going to be the effect of having a center like that close.
Lynn, if you all were to get money today, would that make a difference for you all in terms of being able to keep your doors open or even in the next few weeks? If, let's say, that legislators resolve this and somehow funding was flowing through to social service agencies in the next few weeks, is it too late?
We hope not. Certainly, if something happened today before the end of the month, I would say, that yes, that we could. It would definitely help. I have a conference call a little bit later with our elected officials and with representatives from the governor's office, to go over again what our shortfall is during these summer months and to see if there's something they could do. There's also the stopgap spending bill that's out there. The problem with kind of rising like a phoenix from the ashes, if we're already closed and if a significant period of time goes by, then we lose our licenses, our accreditations, all of those things that you're required to have to provide the services we provide. So, once there's a gap period there, we lose those, and then we would have to reapply and start all over again, which is a very long time-consuming process. So, simultaneously with fighting to stay open and trying to find some way that we can make the math work, we have been reaching out to other providers that may be interested in taking over some services in our county, because that's what's most important, is the services we provide are so critical to the health of our community that, I still can't wrap my brain around the fact that, this would fall victim to this political process.
That's what I was going to ask you, where these people will go. You all have been in Clinton for more than 40 years providing these services. What options will people have?
Well, we have started the notification process because we've been trying to assist our clients as much as possible with where they could receive alternate services. There's not many options here in DeWitt County. There is a small outpatient mental health treatment center at the Rural Health Center at John Warner Hospital. But they, they don't provide the full array of services we provide, and they have very few therapists. So there is going to be this tremendous gap. So we are providing referrals to out-of-county, realizing that we're a rural community. Transportation is a huge issue for many of our clients, and particularly substance abuse clients who may have had their license removed, for them to get to Bloomington or to get to Decatur or to another community where a provider is still providing services is going to be difficult. So we are going to see an impact, no doubt, on law enforcement, on the jail, on the hospitals, to our families in our community, to our clients. We're going to see loss of jobs. We're going to see families in crisis in our community. And, you know, this truly does not have to happen. You know, in a good year, we just break even. This isn't a moneymaker what we do. We are a nonprofit. But we get enough to break even. You know, what's been done to the state budget in the past year with there not being a budget, it's meant that our grants weren't paid. And our grants cover things like crisis and psychiatry. And so now we're a full year behind on having received any of those grant payments. And we've just dipped into every reserve that we have, and we are just now out of cash. So
you
are
all,
trying to...
Yeah, so if you don't hear anything, you all are shutting your doors on Thursday.
Yes. Our board meets again this evening. We've been meeting on a weekly basis. We want to see what the outcome of the discussion with the governor's office and our representatives are today. If they can say, you know, we're looking at this or we're looking at this, then, you know, we may be able to scrape by for a little bit, waiting for some budget stuff to come through. But like I said, I barely covered payroll, and I don't have enough for operational expenses at this point.
Lynn, how many people are in addiction treatments with you all right now, specifically for substance abuse and for heroin,
as we're talking about? It's around 220, I would say.
So there's 220 people, right, last year who were around. Is it that right now as well?
Yes, that's a yearly total.
Right. So that's how many people are going to be in just in that one area of your program services
just
that are going to be
in that one area. And with if you combine mental health and substance abuse, you're looking at an excess of 550 people in our county that rely on our services will have to go either out of county or find another alternative in our county. We have been reaching out to providers that may be interested in coming into DeWitt County and to provide some of the services here. Those talks are still ongoing, so there would definitely be a gap in services. In addition, we provide services for those with developmental disabilities. We have a program out at our East Building, and where it's called Developmental Training, and it's a day program for individuals that do have disabilities, and we do individual service plans with them and work with them Monday through Friday, 9 to 3, to develop their goals based upon their skill level and their wishes and desires. We provide employment opportunities for them if that's what they would like to do. Some, it's a little bit more basic. They'd like to learn how to tell time, how to tie their shoes. Some need total care. And then we do everything we can to provide them with that dignity and the, you know, all the support that they need to live full and productive lives.
Lynn Scoville, thanks for joining us. A look at what will be ending on Thursday, if nothing else happens, with the state budget impasse with DeWitt County Human Resource Center. Thanks for taking the time with us on what I'm sure is a very busy day for you.
Yes, it is. It's going to be a rough couple days.
Thanks also to Kevin Barlow and to Edith Brady Lenny from the Pantograph for joining us as well. You're listening to The 21st. One last topic for us today. How much sleep should babies and children be getting at night? Well, probably more than you think. How much more? According to a new study by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, infants should sleep up to 16 hours a day. 3 to 5-year-olds should get at least 10 and up to 13 hours a day. And even teenagers should be getting 8 to 10 hours a night. As you're looking at the children and young people in your life, is that the case? Joining us now to explain a little bit more about this is a pediatrician with the Carle Health System in Urbana, Anna Zimmer. Dr. Zimmer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Are these new guidelines different from previous ones? We're looking at children in sleep.
They don't differ that much. The main thing is that now we're putting an exact time frame, a range of hours that kids should be getting per night. And previously, you know, we talked about letting kids sleep when they're tired. We know that when we're well rested, we perform better. Kids do better in school. They feel better emotionally. And so, you know, it's nice to just kind of have some guidelines to give parents now.
And for younger children, this is cumulative sleep. So for infants and for younger children, this is counts nap time in there as well.
That's right. So, you know, up until about 3 or 4 years, there's probably at least one nap in there. Towards that age is where it starts to shift more towards just an overnight sleep.
And as we're thinking about that, what about there's it's interesting that so those are younger children. How much sleep is recommended for older children if we're thinking about kids who are maybe like 6 to 12?
Yeah, so in that range, the new guidelines say about 9 to 12 hours. And so, yeah, so it's a little longer than you'd have adolescents or teenagers, but again, shorter than younger kids.
So 12 hours if you're 12 years old, they should be getting at maximum 12 and at least 9 hours.
Yeah, so it sounds like a pretty long time when you think about it, and especially with everything else that kids have going on these days. They're pretty busy with sports, activities with school. So, yeah, it can be hard to get all those hours in.
Well, and I think especially when we're talking about teenagers. So do they? The guidelines say 13 to 18 should sleep 8 to 10 hours a day. That's the first time that the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has issued guidelines for teenagers. And as we wonder why, is there a reason why you think they issued this for the first time? I imagine it's because they think teenagers aren't sleeping enough.
Yeah, I think that's something that pediatricians and people who deal with teenagers know pretty well. I mean, we're all used to seeing the teenagers who are tired, who are falling asleep in school, who are wanting to sleep in past the time they need to get up for school, and who sleep on weekends until noon. And part of that problem, too, is that teenagers tend to have a shift in when they fall asleep. So it's called delayed sleep phase, but they don't feel sleepy until 1 or 2 in the morning, and then getting that full 8 hours of sleep in before you're starting school in your day can be really difficult.
Well, and it's also almost impossible when you think about start times, because the way we think about school start times, it's sort of weird because the oldest kids normally start the earliest. I mean, is there, and I wonder if how much of that, if there's any pressure, and we've seen now a couple of years of these guidelines from different pediatricians and the Academy of Sleep Medicine, do you think any of that may have any effect on school start times? Because that's probably one of the biggest problems here.
Yeah, I think that would be great. I think later school start times would really benefit teenagers. It would help them get their sleep. It would help them perform better in school. But I think that if there's going to be any change, it's going to be gradual and it's going to be hard to make that change. We're so set in our schedules right now with when that school time starts. It kind of goes along with when job time starts. And so having it start later is going to be a transportation issue. It's also going to push everything else later. So later in the evening with sports and after school activities, I think it would just take some time for school districts and everyone to figure all that out.
So what can families do, especially when we're talking about teenagers? Because as you said, there's a lot of different activities, and there's homework, and there's after school activities, and there's sports. If you're talking about a teenager, what advice do you have for families in terms of getting the amount of sleep for all of your kids?
Yeah, so I think it can be really hard. I think you have to kind of figure out your priorities and what works for you as a family. So some kids feel like they need to be in all these activities for their future goals, for getting into college and for starting their careers. But, you know, at some point you need to limit that because sleep is important. You're not going to function as well in your day, and that's also going to affect how your future career if you don't get that sleep. So, you know, in general, I talk to them about what can we limit, you know, what's kind of the low-hanging fruit, what can we get rid of first that isn't going to have such a big impact on the child, on their well-being, and trying to just free up some time for sleep and for getting that good sleep in.
Dr. Zeemer, do you think families take sleep seriously? I think when you have young children, it's very much an important part of the process. We think babies have to sleep, and we let younger toddlers have naps, and then I think once kids are out of the nap phase, maybe parents just think, all right, there's nothing I can do now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, as young kids, we think about it a lot because it's one of the few things that we feel like we're in charge of as their parents. And once they kind of shift over into having more of those activities and sports, it kind of takes a back burner to that sometimes because there's so many things that we're trying to get in place for our children and make sure that they have full, happy lives. And so I think it is important to think about sleep. And I think you might be right that sometimes as they get older, that slides away.
And do you think screen time makes a difference with older? Do we know that if having being connected on your phone or other having tablets or other devices in bed, does that make it harder for kids to fall asleep as well?
Definitely. I think that's a big problem with teenagers today. So having a screen in your room with you, especially if it's something like a cell phone where you can constantly be getting texts or all those other things, Twitter, Facebook, everything that kids are attached to these days. You know, there's those constant updates, your phone making noise, but there's also the light from the screen, and that kind of mimics daytime light, and it can inhibit the melatonin in your brain so that actually that helps you not sleep more, which is not a good thing if you're already not getting enough sleep. So in general, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends not having any screens in the room and not looking at them for at least 30 minutes before bed.
30 minutes before bed. That's a good guideline from Dr. Ziemer. She's a pediatrician with the Carle Health System in Urbana, talking to us about the new American Academy of Sleep Regulation guidelines. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Ziemer.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always connect with us online. Search for 21stshow.org, and it's got all the links. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. Have a good day.